On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. You have aligned to State Representative Joel Kitchens of Sturgeon Bay. So here's our roadmap. We'll ask about the status of broadband and where projects stand to get Wisconsinites connected. We'll look at educating kids in the pandemic, and we'll start with COVID in the Door Peninsula. Hospitalizations are on the rise. Door County's Health Department is working with the National Guard to hold free COVID testing events every Monday for 8 weeks. The first community testing day is today. How has the pandemic affected your community? What do you want lawmakers to do to mitigate the spread? Healthcare workers, what can you share? We're at 800-642-1234. Joel Kitchens is a Republican state representative for the 1st Assembly District, including Door and Kewaunee counties, plus areas of Brown and Manitowoc counties. Representative Kitchens, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Well, looking at the situation of COVID-19 in your district, what are you seeing? Door County and northeastern Wisconsin is showing a surge of cases.
Yeah, and we're one of the most severely affected areas, obviously. So it's been difficult. What we're seeing is that it's being spread, almost exclusively, it seems, with family gatherings, weddings, that type of thing. So a lot of community spread. Of course, in Door County, we still have tourists coming up, and our hospitals have dealt with some of them that have come with the disease, I think. So that's the situation. It's very serious. I spoke with the chief of our internal medicine department at the hospital this morning, just to get one of the most recent information. And they had 2 hospitalizations over the weekend. So, I think we're doing pretty well with our hospital capacity, but it's a smaller hospital, so it's always precarious. If we had a big surge, it could overwhelm it.
Yeah, I looked at the CEO of Door County Medical Center. It said a couple days ago the hospital has 6 rooms, isolation rooms for COVID, and is consistently has 5 or 6 patients with COVID-19 hospitalized. Can your hospitals meet the need?
Well, so far they're feeling pretty good, but again, it's on the edge. If we had a big surge, and you worry with things like Thanksgiving coming up, if we have a big surge, it could be difficult. So we're really working on trying to educate the public. I think that's the big goal, to get people to take this seriously and to maybe postpone some of these events.
DHS Secretary Andrea Palm is expected to be in court this morning to defend Governor Evers' order that limits indoor gatherings. And as you know, that order is blocked after the Tavern League sued last week, arguing the order would force businesses to close. So should indoor gatherings at businesses, including bars and restaurants, be limited to 25% of a building's capacity?
Oh, boy, first off, I will say that we are seeing very little spread at businesses. That's what my public health people tell me. Very, very little of it is being spread that way. The primary area of spread is these private gatherings, which are not covered by that regulation. I don't know if 25% is the right number. I think that our businesses are being very careful around here. The few times I've gone into restaurants, I guess, they've had the tables separated. A lot of them have put up plexiglass in between the tables and that kind of thing. So, again, I don't know the exact number. I see a lot of other states around us, if they have a limit, it's like 50%. So I'm not sure what the right number is. I'm not really taking a position on that court case. We'll see how that plays out, and we'll, play it by ear, I guess.
Should the administration be going through the rules-making process? What is your take on the Joint Committee for Review of Administrative Rules?
Yeah, it gets into a difficult area, because I think that's the normal way that we do things, would be to go through that. I think it's been unfortunate that we've had so much sort of animosity between the administration and the legislature, because I think that fogs the message. I think the real key to us getting this under control is going to be public education and just getting people to follow the CDC guidelines. And all of these arguments that we have in the court cases just kind of detract from that message and make it more politicized. So that's the unfortunate part of it. But I mean, the governor certainly has sidestepped, the law on a lot of these things. But then, it's a two-way street. I would just like us to unify on this message, and I hope that's what's the governor has asked for us. What's your plan? And I'm hopeful that our plan will be that we come together and actually jointly put things out to really push this and get people to follow these guidelines, because we can't monitor every private gathering in people's homes, and that's where the spread is really happening.
We're talking with Joel Kitchens, who represents District 1 in the State Assembly. We're looking at issues affecting the northeastern part of the state. Of course, COVID affecting all of the state as well. With your questions, what is on your mind this election season? What would you like to ask or share with your representative? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Patrick, who is joining us from Richland County this morning. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for taking my call and great show. I would like to ask the representative, seeing that we know and have known from the beginning that the best way to stop the spread of COVID is to wear a mask when you're in public, particularly in buildings. Would he please explain to us how being anti-mask is not pro-COVID?
Well, I'm not anti-mask. So I mean, I'm not sure how to answer that, because that's not my position. I certainly have pushed at every opportunity, and while we were allowed to, we put out newsletters every single day, and in every one of those, we urged people to wear masks. So yeah, I think that we all should. And again, I think it goes back to, if we're going to get this under control, it's going to be through public education. The mask mandate didn't work very well, but it's not because masks don't work. It's because there was poor compliance and no enforcement. So the only way we're going to win on this is if the public accepts these things. And that's what I think we need to focus on.
How do you feel about the lawsuit challenging Governor Evers' statewide mask mandate?
You know, speaking for myself, I did not favor the legislature supporting that. I thought we should stay out of that. I think that most people would like a mandate, even though it wasn't very effective just because of the poor compliance. I mean, the surge that we experienced happened after the mandate was put in place. So, I'm going to keep going back to that education piece of it. I think personally, I would support a mandate, but I think without the public support, it's not going to be effective. And that's what we need to focus on.
So as you look at what to focus on in order to help stop this spread, rapid spread in Wisconsin, what is the Republicans' approach to addressing the pandemic?
Well, I'm going to keep sounding like a broken record, but again, the governor has sort of challenged us to, okay, bring us your plan. I would like us to work together with the administration. I would like to see, Robin Voss, Scott Fitzgerald, and the governor do joint public service announcements to encourage people to wear these masks, because I think it has gotten to that point where it's so political that we've got to get past that, and get that kind of engagement with it. So that's what I think needs to happen, because I think, the only way we're going to have success is if the public buys into this. People in Wisconsin are very independent, and if you just tell them this is what you have to do without really talking to them about why we need you to do this, an awful lot of people are just going to say, well, I'm not going to do it then. So that's what we need to get past, and it needs to come from both sides.
Democrats have asked Republicans to come to the table, though, and that hasn't happened. Would you support the legislature going into session?
It would depend what we're going into session for, I guess. I think there's been a lot of this saying, oh, we're not coming into session, but not a lot of ideas on what people expect us to do. I think when we're seeing this surge, it's not really been a failure of policy. It's been a failure of compliance. Again, when you look at the other states around us, our rules aren't terribly different from them. But, it's the amount of compliance with these things that is really the problem. And a lot of that is, it has gotten political. And I think that is one of the reasons we have had poor compliance.
State Representative Joel Kitchens of Sturgeon Bay is on the line as we discuss COVID and issues facing the Door Peninsula. Healthcare workers, what can you share? Do you have the resources necessary to care for COVID patients? How has the recession affected you and your family? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute. More State Cap on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have State Representative Joel Kitchens of Sturgeon Bay on the line. His district runs through Door in Kewaunee counties, plus parts of Brown and Manitowoc counties. The CEO of Door County Medical Center told Door County Pulse last week that there's an uptick in admissions, both for COVID and in general hospital admissions. COVID cases have spiked in Door and Kewaunee counties. How are you staying safe? Do you have access to high-speed internet at home? What challenges do you want government to come together on and solve amid the pandemic? It's 800-642-1234. And Republican State Representative Joel Kitchens stays with us for 10 more minutes. Let's take another call now. Deborah is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. I just want to say I noticed the politicians, whoever they are, Republican or Democrat, are constantly blaming the small people at home and small groups, which, yeah, that can spread it. But I think what we really should blame is the president who and any other politician that's coming here and causing gatherings, and mostly the president, because none of them wear masks and very few do. And what's the point if you're going to wear 3 people with masks and 10 people without them? That's the super spreader in our state. Let's get serious.
What would you say there, Representative Kitchens, that it's these large campaign events that are contributing to the spread?
Well, I don't know exactly, you know, how it played out in that event yesterday, but, you know, certainly if there are big events, I think that one was outdoors, although, you know, we've seen that they can still be spread out, you know, it can be spread outdoors as well. So I certainly think that people should be wearing masks if, the, you know, if they're in these gatherings. I don't think that the evidence would say that those are the big problem in our state, certainly not in my area, but nonetheless, I think that we need to be responsible. I mean, I don't think President Trump has handled it very well with the mask thing from the beginning. But then again, I would look at the other side, too, and I see Governor Evers, you know, not explaining to people, not selling it and being a leader on why you need to wear it, instead just saying you have to wear a mask. So I don't think that's been very effective either. Again, we've just gotten too polarized on this.
Well, let's move on to broadband. Since the spring, we've seen the lack of broadband access being a barrier to virtual learning for people to work at home. And your district is mostly rural. What can lawmakers do to expand broadband access?
Well, and we have continually put more and more money. The problem, of course, is in these rural areas, it's not cost effective for the companies to come in and lay the line for these. You know, there's not enough population density. So we have been putting in, more and more money into the budget every time. And really, in the last budget, we were about at the capacity of what the industry can keep up with as far as putting in new fiber. So we need to keep doing that. And it certainly has, this pandemic has certainly demonstrated that we still need it. In my area, with the geology that we have in the rock and the hills, it's particularly challenging. So, we need to get to that point where everyone in the state can have access to high-speed internet, because it's just such an important thing educationally, economically. I think that the key to keeping our small towns viable, I think, is going to be having, you know, rapid broadband. So again, I'm sure that it will be a high priority in the budget coming up.
You previously served as the president of the Sturgeon Bay School Board. Given that experience, how would you like to see schools in your district and elsewhere address COVID and keep kids safe during the pandemic? How do you approach education?
You know, that's a really difficult question, because I think that, you know, we can't just not educate these kids. The way the brain develops, if a kid misses second grade, for instance, and doesn't keep up with their reading, they're going to pay for that for the rest of their lives. And it really is going to widen those achievement gaps that we have between the people in poverty versus those that are not. So I think it's just vital that we teach kids, and I don't think it's possible at this point to do it all that well virtually. So I think it needs to be a local decision how districts handle it, and that obviously the incidence of COVID in that particular area plays into it. You know, I think as much as possible they should try to do it in person, and that's what I think most of the schools are doing. But it does present challenges. We are not seeing cases that are coming out of the schools in my area, although they have challenges with staff that are exposed and have to be quarantined and that kind of thing. But we can't just stop educating these kids because of the virus, and that's happening in too many places. And again, especially for those kids in poverty, we're going to be paying for this for the next, you know, 30 years if we don't, especially teaching kids to read in those early grades.
schools have the funding in order to have the proper PPE, enough staff to have smaller class sizes, and, you know, even changing out their ventilation systems?
You know, I can just respond from my area. I think that they're doing okay. There are certainly challenges. The $2 billion that we got in CARES Act money, the governor has sole discretion over that. So he has put a good bit of it into schools. To be honest, we don't even get reports on how it's being spent. All we do is follow the press releases and try to add up, okay, how much do we think is left? So when people say we should be meeting, well, we don't have control over any of that money, so that limits what we should be meeting about. We did put $75 million of state money in Act 185 when we met in April for additional things that will be needed because of the pandemic. The governor has not come to us yet and asked how he would like that spent. That needs to go through the Joint Finance Committee, but that's some extra money that we will have for those kinds of things if they're needed. I'm not hearing that many complaints right now from my local districts on not having the resources to get it done, though, I will say.
We're talking with Joel Kitchens, who's represents District 1 in the State Assembly. We're looking at COVID. We're looking at issues affecting northeastern Wisconsin in particular. With your questions as well, how has the recession affected you? How would you like state government to address the financial impacts of COVID-19? Small business owners, how are you managing? What support do you need? What grants have you sought? We're at 800-642-1234. Representative, let's talk water. You represent Kewaunee County, and over the last few years, we've learned about the nitrate contamination of private wells in the area and its connectedness to agriculture. What have you heard from your constituents on this issue and the efforts to pass water quality bills?
Yeah, and that's something I spend just a huge amount of time on. It's been a big issue. I think we have made some good progress. Kewaunee County has sort of been the poster child for contaminated wells around the state. But as we saw when they did testing down in the southern part of the state this past year, Kewaunee County probably doesn't even have the worst water in the state. I think it's very widespread. So we did get, you know, we've got new rules put in that are specific to our area. We have very fragile geology with shallow soil and cracked bedrock, so it's very easy for contaminants to get down into the groundwater. So we did get new rules put in for manure that were specific to our area. That was a big win. You know, we have grants that are going to these farm groups because a lot of them, they understand the problem and they're trying some innovative practices, putting on, you know, cover crops in the wintertime and different things like that to prevent the contaminants from going into the groundwater. So I think that's money well spent. We had a package of bills that came out of the Speaker's Task Force on Clean Water out of this last session, which we passed all of those bills through the Assembly, but unfortunately when the pandemic hit, the Senate never took them up. So we're going to need to come back and get those all passed right away at the beginning of the next session.
Yeah, the Kewaunee County Land and Water Committee is pursuing a resolution for the county board to get the state senate to convene an extraordinary session to pass those 13 water quality bills. What is your take on that? The county board is set to meet tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy that they're doing that. I would love to see the Senate do that, but I'm not holding my breath on it. And, you know, honestly, with some of those that spent money, I think that there was some concern by the senators that, you know, obviously our budget got blown up by the pandemic and they're more reluctant to spend money. But some of them don't spend very much money. I would love to see them take those bills up. But again, the Senate frustrates me very often, so I'm not holding my breath on that. But if we don't get them passed before the end of this session, certainly they'll be top priority at the beginning of next session.
How are you engaging farmers on this issue and getting them to the table to discuss water quality challenges?
Yeah, I think that's been the key to the success that we've had in Kewaunee County. And I do think at this point, again, when they had those problems in the southern part of the state, the first thing they did was call Kewaunee County and say, wow, how have you guys gotten so much done so quickly on this? And that's been the key. And in my prior life, I was a large animal veterinarian, so I have good relationships and good trust in the farm community. So, I think a lot of these things, we've really gotten good buy-in from the farmers, and some of these bills that we've passed, almost all of them have had support from both the agriculture community and the environmental community. So that's what we're really aiming for, because, you know, it's sort of similar to how we're handling the pandemic. If you don't have buy-in from the stakeholders, you're not going to be successful. So I've been very proud that we've actually gotten very good buy-in from the more progressive farmers in the area, because that really is going to be the key. If they're just going to try to regulate their way out of this, it's never going to be successful. But if the farmers understand the problem and really are engaged in trying to solve it, that's how we're going to make progress, and that's what's happening.
So very quickly, when you talk about buy-in with COVID, how do you get Wisconsinites to do the right thing? How do you get that buy-in?
Again, I think it's going to be a bipartisan effort. I would love to see us have a PR campaign and have, again, the governor together with the speaker and the majority leader of the Senate and, you know, stand together on this with masks and just encourage people to say, look, we need to get over the politics of this. We need to wear a mask. It is one of the most important tools that we have in slowing the spread of this. You know, we know that nothing the government does is going to solve this problem. Until there's a vaccine, we're going to have to live with it, but we can slow the spread. And masks are one of the most important weapons in doing that. So I want us to, I would love to see us do just a statewide bipartisan PR campaign. I am anxious for the election to be over. I think that it's unfortunate that this had to happen during an election year. I think it's influenced too much the policy.
Representative Kitchens, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Joel Kitchens, a Republican from Sturgeon Bay, represents District 1 in the State Assembly. State Cap continues with DCF Secretary Emily Amundson right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Workers are facing big barriers to stay in the workforce as childcare options dwindle, assistance dries up. Parents are largely on their own when companies need their employees to work on site, or they must continue their jobs remotely, care for kids at their feet. More than 800,000 American women dropped out of the workforce last month, a significantly higher number than men. What is your childcare situation? Can you get a spot in a licensed provider? Do you run a childcare center? What are you facing? Let's talk about it. 800-642-1234. Emily Amundson is Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families. Secretary Amundson, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. Nice to be here on a Monday morning.
Well, what is the state of Wisconsin childcare 7 months into the pandemic? Are licensed childcare centers going dark?
Yeah, so you guys have been so great at checking up on the status of childcare in Wisconsin throughout this pandemic. And as you know, going into the COVID-19 crisis, Wisconsin was in a pretty precarious place. Almost 70% of rural areas classified as child care deserts, which means there just aren't enough spots for families that need them, and really uneven distribution of spots. We had workforce issues. We had obviously the ballooning cost of care for families is becoming almost too challenging to bear. And that was the context that we found ourselves in when the crisis hit. And from there, we saw a high of almost 40% of providers close their doors mid-March, and that was really our high point. The good news is that since then, because of the stimulus, the federal stimulus and stabilization efforts through the CARES Act funding, as well as some discretionary spending by Governor Evers in the child care industry, we've been able to really stabilize the industry. So what we see now is only 5.3% of providers, right around 235 providers still report that their doors are closed, but we've been able to retain 95% of our providers through this crisis. And that's absolutely due to the investment that Governor Evers has made in this critical backbone industry. So those CARES Act dollars are huge for this industry.
And those CARES Act dollars, huge. You know, Wisconsin a decade ago had nearly 9,000 licensed child care providers. Last time we spoke, we were at about 4,500. Why is that? Why are there so few today?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. We see what we've seen over the past decade. And again, these statistics mirror national statistics, is there are fewer family care providers than ever before. So there was a 69% decline in the number of family care providers. So those places that, you know, open their homes to a relatively small amount of children. And we've seen about a 10% decline in terms of the large centers. Now, some of that has to do with large centers, you know, getting larger and taking on more children. And really the trend nationally for parents to choose a center over a family care provider. But I think the big story here is that the margins are really, really razor thin in this industry. It is not a money-making industry. It's built off a workforce that makes on average between $10 and $13 an hour, oftentimes without benefits. And yet the cost of care is often more than college tuition for families like mine with two children. And so it's just a very difficult calculus to make work. And that's one of the things that we're looking at through our work with the Preschool Development Grant, which is an opportunity that Wisconsin has to really transform its to five system over the next 5 years. So this is a system that we're really looking at, and we're hoping over a 5-year period of time to be able to say that we've stabilized some of what we see are these 10-year trends.
So as you look at the CARES Act stimulus, Wisconsin has put about $130 million plus dollars toward child care centers since the pandemic started. How accessible are these funds to these child care centers? I mean, how quickly can they get these dollars, and what is the bureaucracy, I would have to say, in order to get these funds?
Yeah, so you know, in terms of the level of accessibility of these funds, we've tried to really be very clear and consistent through. We've had now we'll be opening up our third round of funding in a little over a week. And really, we need to make sure that centers are in good standing, that they're licensed. And we have a stipulation to ensure that we're making sure that these funds are going out to centers that are serving at least a third of their population in that 0 to 5 space. And that's really to make sure that that we maintain the number of spots available in Wisconsin. So I mentioned that that statistic around child care deserts. We can't afford to see another infant and toddler slot converted into a school-age slot. We recognize that right now parents are facing just absolutely incredible hurdles and difficult decisions around their school-age children. I've got two of them myself. And we are so grateful for the school age program that have really shifted to accommodate our shifting landscape in the school aged environment. But these programs are really intended to support that 0 to 5 space to ensure that we have those kinds of options moving forward, you know, hopefully recovering out of the economic crisis that we're in right now. When it comes to accessing the funds, great story here. So on our second round of funding, because we built our system off much of the information that providers already report to Department of Children and Families, we opened our last round of funding application at 12 o'clock midnight. The first application was completed, ready to be reviewed at 12:06. Wow. And so I'm hopeful that providers at this point are able to get into our system, hit a few update buttons, and be ready to go in less than 10 minutes. That's the system we built.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Emily Amundson, who's Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families. We're discussing issues facing families, childcare amid the pandemic, taking your questions. What is your childcare situation? How has your work been affected by the needs of your children? Care providers, are you confident in your center's safety precautions? Do you have the financial support you need to stay open? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Secretary, what resources are available for parents who are struggling to cover the cost of childcare? They can't go back to work if they can't hold on to that slot, that precious slot at daycare.
Yeah, this is such a difficult thing. And I was actually just talking with brother over the weekend who was sharing stories from his childcare situation. And, you know, I know a lot of families right now are experiencing that feeling of uncertainty that comes with the ballooning number of COVID-19 cases in Wisconsin. And certainly as we see cases tick up in Wisconsin, just among our general population, that has an impact on a center's ability to open and close. And what we're seeing a lot of right now are, you know, the contact tracing that then impacts the quarantining of staff members or potentially shutting down of a room in a center. And that is incredibly stressful when it comes to providing that care. I think some of the work that we've been doing and certainly that I've been doing is really trying to talk and connect to our business community, to industry leaders, and try to normalize these conversations around child care and around what families, working parents are facing right now. It is incredibly stressful. It sometimes feels like a day-to-day and a week-to-week conversation about how do you sort of move through and navigate this environment, knowing that at any time you could get a call, say, you know, you're going to be quarantined or your kiddo has to come home for a few weeks because of a case of exposure. I think that business leaders, employers need to understand and really be part of finding those flexible solutions. And they have been very warm to this idea. I've been incredibly indebted to my colleague, WEDC CEO Missy Hughes, for really getting out and being vocal on this issue with the business community. And they have been really receptive. I think that they understand now that they need to be part of the solution. And, you know, your intro talks about this concept of the female recession. We have for 50% of our Wisconsin workforce as female now, and yet those women are often asked to make the difficult decision when families are put in the position of care being either difficult to find or difficult to sustain. So I really ask for the partnership in the business community to help us navigate through some of these challenges that we're facing right now. DCF has also created some tools to help match the supply and demand, and this is something that we did not have pre-COVID. But recognizing that families may need to shift even temporarily because of a closure, because of a situation beyond their control, we've really taken more of a direct hand in helping to link families with slots that may be open in their community.
Let's pause right there. We have DCF Secretary Emily Amundson with us as we look at what families are facing 7 months into this pandemic. Caregivers, are you confident your center's safety precautions are okay? Do you have the financial backing to stay open? How have costs changed during the pandemic? Educators, what are your concerns? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Secretary Amundson here on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Emily Amundson, the Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families. The pandemic has forced more women to leave the workforce, as we've been talking about, and the pandemic has plunged daycare centers into crisis. A survey in July by the National Association for the Education of Young Children, it found that 40% of centers surveyed will shutter permanently without more funding. Secretary, you're talking there about tools to match supply and demand. What are these tools?
So we have an online map of Wisconsin, and it's updated in real time. Providers are able to get in and indicate when they have an available slot. And then we do have a partner organization that helps to match individual families with open slots. You can use it just by accessing our website, or you can actually go through your child care resource and referral center and utilize these services to help find open and available care. And every community in Wisconsin has that access to child care resource and referral networks.
How are centers doing on PPE, personal protective equipment?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that's been a real challenge to restore those supply lines. It's something we've been hearing from providers, you know, from the start of the pandemic. And DCF is working to connect providers with PPE. We're actually doing this in real time and trying to get these resources out across the state as we speak. Again, Governor Evers did work through the Emergency Operations Center to be able to connect the childcare industry with PPE. That said, it's taken a long time and supply lines are slow. And so what we're hearing from providers is that they've really had to be creative to find and restore those supply lines. And obviously the cost of the additional cleaning and the additional PPE and really even just the cost of enhanced protocols, so staffing patterns and changes that they need to accommodate the kinds of safety protocols that they now have in their centers, that's all incredibly expensive. And that's one of the big reasons that we developed the supplementary payment programs as we did, because we recognize that the costs incurred through this pandemic are incredible. And I think it's really important for listeners to understand that while Wisconsin has done an excellent job of investing in this industry through the pandemic, these are intended to be emergency funds and really intended to fill holes that have already existed and been exacerbated by the pandemic. These are not forward-looking funds. And so those same challenges that I led with that we saw pre-pandemic, they're going to exist and they're going to be exacerbated if we do not see additional funding from the federal government and we don't see additional state resources invested in helping centers recover from the COVID-19 pandemic. We are not seeing centers fully staffed, most centers have open and available slots right now, or they have open and available rooms, but they do not have the early care and education workforce to actually open that room. So we've got challenges, too, in attracting early care and education providers back to the classroom.
And that comes down to wages and salary?
It absolutely comes down to wages and salary. You know, when the average salary is between $10 and $13 an hour, I think folks looked around during the pandemic and thought, you know, there are other things that I could be doing. The wage is incredibly low, particularly when you look across the level of education that most of our early care and education workforce has. So attracting that high-quality workforce back to the profession is part of our short-term plan as well as our long-term plan. And there is a dedicated pot of funding in this new round of $50 million that is intended to increase wages of early care and education professionals.
By how much, approximately?
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, what?
By how much? By how much is the goal to increase wages?
Yeah, so I believe it's up to $5 per hour that we're capping, and long term, that's something that we just need to look at. I think that we need to start to shift a conversation about early care and education to one that more closely mirrors the K-12 sector. And I think that if there is a silver lining within the COVID-19 crisis, it's a recognition that child care is as important as a backbone industry to supporting working families as our K-12 environment is. And there are a lot of similarities between how families rely on early care and education and K-12. We ought to be shifting the conversation to be thinking about how we support from the state level the early care and education sector.
We're talking with Emily Amundson, Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families. We're looking at the pressing issues facing families amid the pandemic, taking your questions as well at 800-642-1234. Secretary, let's talk about domestic abuse. There was a report last month that indicates the number of domestic homicide victims rose 36% in 2019. What is known about why domestic violence and abuse is rising in our state?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the this narrative has been something that we've been fearful of. We talk a lot about this in terms of child welfare as well, and the welfare of children, the welfare of families. We're living through, you know, what I think history will remember as one of the most stressful times for families that you know, this country has ever seen. And so I think it's in this time where we have to remember how to look for the signs. We believe that the signs are still there. We know that families that were experiencing trauma, having difficulties pre-pandemic, are probably feeling those feelings ever so more deeply now that we're mid-pandemic. And it's frankly a good reminder that we all need to be good stewards and good neighbors. We all need to recognize the signs of abuse and neglect, and we all need to check on one another. It's something that we just absolutely cannot afford to forget about.
Recall, you know, abuse and neglect cases for children dropped a lot in during the quarantine time in the early stages of the pandemic. What do you see now?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen sort of a predictable increase, you know, sort of in line with what you would see in a normal summertime environment. So we're still sort of anticipating that rise that would come with folks kind of rejoining, you know, their normal external activities. We haven't seen that big spike, you know, but we're still planning for it. We're still planning for what may come when, you know, society returns to sort of that normal cadence. And again, I think as people adjust to this virtual environment, what we're noticing is many of the signs of abuse and neglect are similar and perceptible in a virtual environment. And so as educators get better at navigating the virtual environment with children, I think they also get better as our number one mandated reporter group. They also get better at sort of using that system that we've built. Now, you know, in terms of out-of-home care placements, we know they're still safely happening, but, you know, as the weather gets colder, we need to continually be reviewing our health and safety recommendations for counties on how we make sure that that family visits and things like that still happen, but happen in a safe environment. You know, we're still asking people to just stay at home when they can, wear a mask, to wash their hands, and hopefully we get back to normal quickly.
Secretary Amundson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Emily Amundson is Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families. Earlier, we talked with State Representative Joel Kitchens of Sturgeon Bay. Just ahead, we talk with a clinical psychologist about youth mental health and the challenges and how to help. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.